prepped my soft serve, that vanilla hit I used, so as not to double fault. Barely daring to breathe, I tossed the ball high and felt it connect with the racket in a way that, while not entirely pleasant, was at least tolerable. It landed neatly in the center of the square, without any heat. I'd been aiming for the back right corner, but I'd take it. I shook out my wrist, grimacing at how constricting the Velcro brace felt, but knowing better than to take it off. And then I gave the second ball a toss and slammed it, angling the racket to put a slight spin on the serve. I landed on my good leg, but the momentum carried me forward along with my follow-through. I stumbled, accidentally putting too much weight on my knee, and the pain caught me off guard. By the time it had begun to fade back into the familiar, dull ache that never quite went away, the ball had rolled silently to a stop at my feet, mocking me. My serve had faltered. I hadn't even made it over the net. I was done. I left the balls on the court, zipped my racket back into my gear bag, and picked up my cane, wondering why I'd even bothered. When I locked up the courts, the campus felt spooky all of a sudden, the dark shadows of the foothills looming over the empty buildings. But of course, there was nothing to be worried about. Nothing besides the first day of school, when I'd finally have to face everyone I'd been avoiding all summer. Eastwood High used to be mine, the one place where everyone knew who I was, and it felt as though I could do no wrong. And the tennis courts. I'd been playing on varsity since the ninth grade. Back when the school was mine, I used to find peace there, between the orderly white lines etched into the forest green rectangles. Tennis was like a video game, one that I'd beat a million times, with the pleasure of winning long gone. A game that I'd kept on playing because people expected me to, and I was good at doing what people expected. But not anymore, because no one seemed to expect anything from me anymore. The funny thing about gold is how quickly it can tarnish. 3. There are a lot of unexpected public humiliations in high school, but none of them had ever happened to me until 8:10 a.m. on that first day of senior year. Because at 8:10 a.m., I realized that not only did I have no one to sit with during the welcome back pep rally, but I was also going to have to take the front row, since the bleachers were too cramped for my knee. The front row was all teachers and this one goth girl in a wheelchair who insisted she was a witch. But there was no way that I was going to hobble feebly up the stairs with the whole school watching. And they were watching. I could feel their eyes on me, and not because I'd won a record percentage of the vote in the class council elections or held hands with Charlotte Hyde as we waited in the coffee line in the upper quad. This was different. It made me want to cringe away in silent apology for the dark circles under my eyes and the fact that I had no summer tan to speak of. It made me want to disappear. A balloon arch and butcher paper sign decorated each section of the bleachers. I sat directly beneath the R in Go Seniors and watched the leaders of the Student Government Association huddle together in the center of the basketball court. They wore plastic lays and sunglasses. Jill Nakamura, our new class president, was dressed in a bikini top and denim cutoffs. And then the huddle broke apart, and then I caught sight of Charlotte laughing with her friends in their short song squad skirts. Her eyes met mine, and she looked away, embarrassed. But that one moment had told me all I needed to know. The tragedy of what had happened at Jonas Biedecker's party was mine and mine alone. And then a small miracle happened, and Toby Ellicott sat down next to me.
"Did you hear about the bees?"
he asked cheerfully. "What?"
"They're disappearing," he said. "Scientists are stumped. I read it in the newspaper this morning."
"Maybe it's a hoax," I said. "I mean, how can you prove something like that?"
"A bee census?" he suggested. "Anyhow, I'm going to buy stock in honey."
Toby and I hadn't really spoken in years. He was on the debate team, and our schedules rarely overlapped. He didn't look much like the pudgy, bespectacled best friend I'd lost somewhere in the first few weeks of seventh grade. His dark hair still flopped all over the place, but he was a lanky 6'2". He straightened his bow tie, unbuttoned his blazer, and stretched his legs way out in front of him, as though the teacher bleacher was a choice seat.
"You should get a sword cane," he said. "That would be badass. I know a guy if you're interested."
"You know a sword cane guy?"
"Don't sound so surprised at my shadowy connections, Faulkner. Technically, he deals in concealed weaponry."
The music started then, a deafening blast of speaker static that gave way to the opening bars of an overplayed Vampire Weekend single. SGA began clapping in that cheesy, let's get the party started way, and Jill squealed into the microphone how super psyched she was for the best school year ever. Inexplicably, SGA launched into some sort of coordinated hula dance in their sunglasses and lays. I couldn't get over how wrong it was, doing the hula to the African drum beats of an East Coast prep rock band. "Please tell me I'm hallucinating," Toby muttered.
"Seniors, where's your school spirit?"
Jill called. The response was deafening.
"I can't hear you,"
Jill challenged, cocking her hip.
"Kill me now," moaned Toby. "I would, but I seem to be lacking a sword cane," I told him.
Mrs. Levine, who was sitting next to Toby, glared at us.
"Behave or leave, gentlemen," she snarled.
Toby snorted. When the song finally ended, Jimmy Fuller took the microphone. He was wearing his tennis warm-ups, and I couldn't help but notice that the team had gotten new uniforms.
"What's up, Eastwood?"
he boomed.
"It's time to meet your varsity sports teams."
As if on cue, a side door to the gym opened and the football team poured out in their pads and jerseys. Behind them was the baseball team, then tennis, then water polo. But by that point, I'd stopped paying attention to the teams and their orders. My former life, in its entirety, was standing in the center of the basketball court, while I sat on the teacher bleacher, and there was no way in hell that I was going to clap for them. Mostly, I just wanted to get out of that pep rally and away from all of it.
"Hey, Ezra,"
Toby whispered loudly.
"Got a nicotine patch, buddy?"
"Get out,"
Mrs. Levine demanded.
"Both of you, now."
Toby and I looked at each other, shrugged, and shouldered our bags. It was bright outside, the sky cloudless and impossibly blue. I winced and hung back in the shade of the stucco overhang, fumbling for my sunglasses.
"A nicotine patch?" I asked.
"Well, it got us kicked out, didn't it?"
Toby said smugly.
"Yeah, I guess it did. Thanks."
"For what? I wanted to get out of there. Mrs. Levine has awful breath."
We wound up passing the time in the annex, this study room that connected the debate and newspaper classrooms. Everyone else was at the rally, and we could hear muffled screams coming from the gym at regular intervals.
"It sounds like Disneyland or something,"
Toby offered with a grin. I was surprised he'd mention it.
"Have you been back?" I asked.
"Are you kidding? I'm there every single day. They gave me a free lifetime pass. I'm like the mayor of Adventureland."
"So no, then," I said.
"Have you?"
I shook my head.
"You could get a handicapped pass,"
Toby pressed.
"Skip all the lines.
Next time I ask a girl on a date, I'll be sure to mention that."
For some reason, I didn't mind Toby giving me crap about the cane, and I was generally pretty sensitive about it. You would be, too, if you'd spent most of your summer vacation trying to get your well-meaning but overbearing mother to stop hovering outside the bathroom door every time you took a shower. She was paranoid that I'd slip and die since I'd refused to let her install those metal handrails. I was paranoid that she'd come inside and catch me, showering.
"What are you doing for team electives?"
Toby asked. We had a 4-year requirement.
"Speech and debate," I admitted, suddenly realizing that Toby might be in my class.
"Dude, I'm team captain this year. You should compete."
"I'm just taking it for the requirement," I said. "Debate's not really my thing."
Back then, my impression of the debate team was that it was a bunch of guys who put on business suits during the weekend and thought they actually had something meaningful to say about foreign policy because they were enrolled in AP government.
"Maybe not, but you owe me. I got us out of the pep rally,"
Toby protested.
"We're even. I told Tug Mason not to piss in your backpack in the 8th grade locker room."
"You still owe me. He pissed in my Gatorade instead."
"Huh. I'd forgotten about that."
The bell rang then.
"Hey, Faulkner, want to know something depressing?"
Toby asked, picking up his bag.
"What?"
"First period hasn't even started yet."
4. The one interesting thing about being signed up for speech and debate was that I'd been given a humanities odd schedule. Eastwood High is on block scheduling, and ever since freshman year, my schedule had been humanities even with the other athletes, but not anymore. I had first period AP Euro, which was unfortunate because, one, Mr. Anthony, the tennis coach, was the AP Euro teacher, and two, his classroom was on the second floor of the 400 building, which meant that, three, I had to get up a flight of stairs. Over the summer, stairs had become my nemesis, and I often went out of my way to avoid a public confrontation with them. I was supposed to pick up an elevator key from the front office. It came in a matching set with that little blue parking tag for my car, the one I was never, ever going to display. By the time I got to AP Euro via a rarely used stairwell near the staff parking lot, Mr. Anthony had already begun taking roll. He paused briefly to frown at me over the manila folder, and I cringed in silent apology as I slid into a seat in the back. When he called my name, I mumbled, "Here," without looking up. I was surprised he had actually called me. Usually teachers did this thing when they reached my name on the roll sheet. "Ezra Faulkner is here," they'd say, putting a tick in the box before moving on down the list. It was as though they were pleased to have me, as though my presence meant the class would be better somehow. But when Coach A paused after calling my name and I had to confirm for him that I was in the room, even though he knew damn well that I'd walked in 30 seconds late, I wondered for a moment if I really was there. I glanced up, and Coach A was giving me that glare he used whenever we weren't hustling fast enough during practice.
"Consider this your tardiness warning, Mr. Faulkner," he said.
"So noted," I muttered. Mr. Anthony continued with roll. I wasn't really listening, but when he got to one name that I didn't quite catch, there was a perceptible shift in the room. A new student. She sat way on the other side near the bookshelves. All I could see was a sleeve of green sweater and a cascade of red hair. The syllabus was nothing surprising, although Mr. Anthony apparently believed otherwise. He talked about what it meant to be in an advanced placement history course, as though we all hadn't taken AP U.S. history with Ms. Welsh as juniors. A lot of the guys on tennis didn't care for Coach Anthony because they thought he was a hard ass. I was used to strict coaches, but I was quickly realizing that without any other athletes in the class, Mr. Anthony was just plain strict.
"You should have done the summer reading,"
Mr. Anthony said, as though it was an accusation rather than a fact.
"Medieval Europe, from the fall of Rome to the Renaissance. If you felt such an assignment was beneath you, then you'll be rearranging your plans for the weekend. You might even consider your weekend plans to be, history.
No one laughed. "The Roman Empire, 200 B.C. to 474 A.D., he scrawled on the board, and then raised an eyebrow, as though enjoying a private joke. There was this horrible stretch of silence as we tried to figure out why he wasn't saying anything, and then finally, Zhao Lin raised his hand. "I am sorry, but I think 476 A.D. is correct," he mumbled.
"Thank you, Mr. Lin, for displaying the barest level of competency in reading comprehension,"
Mr. Anthony snapped, correcting the date on the board.
"And now, I wonder if anyone here can tell us why the phrase Holy Roman Empire is a misnomer. Mr. Faulkner, perhaps?"
If I didn't know better, I would have thought that was a sneer on Coach A's lip. All right, let's call it a sneer. I got that he was disappointed I couldn't play anymore, but I'd sort of hoped he wouldn't be a jerk about it.
"It only applies after Charlemagne,"
I offered, inking over the letters on my syllabus.
"That's a community college answer," Coach announced. "Would you care to rephrase it and try for a UC school?"
I don't know why I said it, except maybe that I didn't want to take crap from Coach A for the rest of the year, but before I could really think it through, I had leaned back in my chair and replied,
"Yeah, okay."
Two reasons. One, the Holy Roman Empire was originally called the Frankish Kingdom until the Pope crowned Charlemagne the Emperor of the Romans. And two, it wasn't holy, or Roman, or even an empire. It was really just like this casual alliance of Germanic tribal states. I'd never really shot my mouth off in class before, and I instantly regretted it. I usually had the right answer when I was called on, and my grades were good enough, but I wasn't what anyone would consider brainy. I'd just done a lot of reading and thinking over the summer because there hadn't been much else to do.
"Enjoy your weekend, Mr. Faulkner,"
Coach sneered, and I realized that instead of getting him off my back, I'd made him want to get back at me.
I'd nearly forgotten we were on pep rally schedule until I was halfway out the classroom door, thinking it was break, and someone tapped me on the shoulder. It was the new girl. She clutched a crumpled class schedule and stared up at me, as though I'd somehow given her the impression that I was the right person to talk to on her first day. I wasn't expecting her eyes. Deep and disquieting and dark blue. The sort of eyes that made you wonder if the skies opened up when she got angry.
Sorry,
she said, glancing back down at her schedule.
First period is supposed to end at 9:35, but the bell didn't ring until 9:50.
It's the pep rally, I told her. Break is canceled, and we go straight to third.
Oh.
She pushed her bangs to the side and hesitated a moment before asking,
So, what do you have next?
AP American Lit.
Me too. Can you show me where that is?
Ordinarily, I could have. On the first day of junior year, I'd even stopped to help a few confused-looking freshmen in the quad who had stood gawking at the maps in the backs of their day planners as though they were stuck in some sort of incomprehensible labyrinth.
Sorry, no,
I said, hating myself for it.
Okay.
I watched her walk away, and I thought about how most of the girls at Eastwood, or at least the ones worth noticing, all looked the same. Blonde hair, lots of makeup, stupidly expensive handbags. The new girl was nothing like that, and I didn't know what to make of the shabby boy's button-down tucked into her jean shorts, or the worn leather satchel slung over her shoulder, like something out of an old-fashioned movie. She was pretty, though, and I wondered where she had come from, and why she hadn't bothered trying to fit in. I wanted to follow her and apologize, or at least explain, but I didn't. Instead, I grappled with a stairwell near the faculty lot, crossed the quad toward the 100 building, and opened the door of AP American Lit several minutes in arrears of the bell. I'd had Mr. Moreno before, for Honors Brit Lit. He'd supposedly been writing the same novel for the past 20 years, and either he genuinely loved teaching, or he'd never outgrown high school, because it was sort of depressing how hard he had tried to get us psyched about Shakespeare. Moreno hadn't cared that I was late for class. He hadn't even noticed. The DVD player wasn't working, and he was on his hands and knees with a disc clutched in his teeth, prodding at the cables. Finally, Luke Shepard, the president of Film Club, arrogantly stepped in, and we all sat and watched The Great Gatsby. The original, not the remake. I hadn't seen it before, and the film was old-fashioned and sort of bored me. The book had been our summer reading, and the movie wasn't nearly as good. What I hated, though, was the part with the car accident. I knew it was coming, but that didn't stop it from being any less terrible to watch. I shut my eyes, but I could still hear it, hear the policeman telling the crowd of onlookers how the son of a bitch didn't even stop his car. Even with my eyes closed, I could feel everyone staring at me, and I wished they wouldn't. It was unsettling the way my classmates watched me, as though I fascinated and terrified them, as though I no longer belonged. When class let out, I briefly considered the quad, with its harsh sunlight and cafe tables. My old crew sat at the most visible table, the one by the wall that divided the upper and lower quads. I pictured them in their new team uniforms, the first day of senior year, telling stories about summer sports camps and beach vacations, laughing over how young the freshmen looked. And then I pictured sitting down at that table. I pictured no one saying anything, but all of them thinking it. You're not one of us anymore. I wasn't class president or tennis team captain. I wasn't dating Charlotte, and I didn't drive a shiny Beamer. I wasn't king any longer, so it was only fitting to take my exile. Which is why, instead of gambling my last few chips of dignity, I wound up avoiding the quad entirely and decamping on that shaded stairwell out near the faculty lot with my headphones on, wondering why I hadn't known it would be quite this bad. There was only one senior-level Spanish class, which meant another year with Mrs. Martin. She had urged us to call her Señora Martinez back in Spanish 1, but that was completely ridiculous on account of her husband being the pastor of the local Lutheran church. She was one of those cookie-baking, overly-mothering types who festooned her sweaters with festive holiday pins and treated us all like second graders. I was the first to arrive, and Mrs. Martin beamed at me and whispered that her congregation had prayed for me after the accident. I could think of so many more worthwhile things they could have prayed for, but I didn't have the heart to tell her.
Gracias, Signora Martinez, I muttered, taking my usual seat.
Yo, Faulkner.
Evan nodded in greeting as he